and welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. The date today is October 1st, 2025, and this is episode 552. I am the co-host, Mark Ames, in the greater Western New York area. You're listening to Radio War Nerd. Subscribe, please, and support the show. Go to patreon.com/RadioWarNerd. Again, I'm not with the War Nerd himself, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, but you should know that he's doing fine. We've been in contact. We just don't want to rush him back to, like, we want to get him back on the show again when he's rested, ready, cleared, and he can talk all about it because no one can talk about his own ailments better than John Dolan. And so, yeah, and he should be back soon. That said, today we are launching a new series with Radio War Nerd guest favorite Anibale on one of the major war subjects of our time, and a subject that I know John and myself have very much kind of avoided, which is World War II, and specifically this is going to be about the infamous Operation Barbarossa. But lucky for us, you know, we have Anibale, who was the one who really first helped bring Radio War Nerd into World War II against our better wishes. But it's turned out a great thing that he has, because there's so much endless relevance as well as, you know, tons of warfare. So first of all, Anibale, thanks for coming back on Radio War Nerd.
Thanks for having me again. Very, very happy to be here, as you know.
So today we're going to do the introduction, the background, the lead up, the elements that go into Operation Barbarossa. But I have a feeling that there are probably going to be a few more episodes after this. And I'm sure that John will be ready by then to join us for future episodes on Barbarossa. Why don't you introduce today what you're going to talk about today?
I'm going to talk about the largest land military operation in the history of humanity, because Barbarossa is just that, is the big one, the largest we have ever been.
And the war podcast ignored it until now, 10 years. I find that to be a feat on its own, but okay.
Well, makes sense considering, the context, considering the fact that you have been doing a lot of brilliant work on different subjects, but this is something I think is unavoidable. It's unavoidable because we are after 80 years, we are back there, and 85 years, we're back there to some extent.
Yeah,
but because it is just he's a larger than life subject. It's enormous. It's very difficult to understand the scale of that operation, and particularly because there will be, perhaps, likely there will be never another Barbarossa again, because the nukes closed whatever possibility to have a pure conventional land operation with millions of people involved over more than 2,000 kilometer front. For some reason, for instance, NATO or Europe would decide to try to emulate Napoleon or Adolf Hitler. I tend to mispronounce it.
Yes.
The response is going to be nukes. And as a general, Italian general once remarked to me, nukes have truly remove any kind of fun from war, which is absolutely true. So it's an enormous. It defined the 20th century. It defined World War II, and so there is a lot we need to deep dive into. It. There is a lot of questions that need to be answered, because even 85 years after June 22nd, 1941, the day Barbarossa was launched, there is still a lot of work to do to try to understand what did really happen, why Barbarossa came to be. But also because we have been through the years under an enormous amount of misinterpretation, misinformation, political use on different side of Barbarossa and the results, the output of Barbarossa. So, I mean, today, tonight, more than any other time I've been with Radio Warner, I will try to bring you what is really not much Annibale's opinion on this and that, but this is really try to convey what is some sort of academic consensus based on the latest research. Of course, there are always going to be people who is going to disagree, particularly on more politicized part. You will always have people, and for instance, I've been reading some kind of ultra pro-market blog somewhere on the internet that, you know, tried to convince me that Adolf Hitler was a Rosa Luxemburg fan.
Yes.
And he thought that Rosa Luxemburg economic idea were just great, and he admired Soviet Union. So he did decide to launch Barbarossa because he did admire Soviet Union. This is nonsense, of course. I mean,
there's that stupid thing that it says National Socialists, therefore they were left-wing wokesters. And this is, communists.
And they were.
Of course,
they
it's
were.
Like saying that the Republicans in the Spanish Civil War were MAGA. Because they called themselves the Republicans, or the Irish exactly. Republican Army is MAGA, even though they're Marxists. Like, it's just exactly. as stupid as it can possibly be. Yeah,
exactly. But is today, tonight, we are going to also to show you why this is stupid. Because part of the reason behind Barbarossa were purely business reason, purely market reason. We're based on a market that maybe cannot be defined a liberal capitalistic market, but we're still in that area.
Private okay? interest, private capital
private interest, and yes. private interest, and private in the most strict sense of the word, because we are going to see that a lot of privately owned large business in Germany was absolutely ecstatic about the idea of launching Barbarossa because they wanted the booty. And they made, also, spoiler, they did real booty list to be given to the Wehrmacht. Okay? So, first, let's start trying to answer what is probably the first question anybody should ask about Barbarossa. Who got the idea? Who did launch it? And, of course, everybody... or the majority will probably say, well, it was Adolf Hitler. In fact, this kind of naive assumption has come under intense scrutiny, particularly in the last 20 years. But, I mean, since the fall of the Soviet Union, the opening of this partial opening of Soviet archives, and the new generation of researcher of what I call the post-David Glantz era, the David Glantz era and the post-David Glantz era. It was more and more being shown that it was a collective endeavor where Adolf Hitler, the sponsor, the business sponsor, the economic sponsor of the Nazi regime, and probably more than anybody else, the German military all together came to the conclusion that Barbarossa had to be launched. And in order to show you that...
I'm going to stop you real quickly because I think people might have got the wrong impression initially when you said it wasn't started just by Hitler. They thought, wait, you mean that crank theory that it was actually Stalin started it and then the Nazis had no choice. But obviously what you mean is this was a collective German elite,
yes, exactly.
The elites of Germany decided exactly. this and exactly. Hitler was the front man for them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He was the right man at the right moment or the wrong man at the wrong moment, depending from your point of view, because he could become the catalyst
right.
for yes. this decision. And of course, someone could argue, well, and this is true, by the way, well, it was inevitable once the World War II was launched, or even it was inevitable once the Nazi Party came to power in Germany. But as I say, it was a collective endeavor. It was something where several agencies and several people came together and created this monstrosity, because it was a monstrosity for reason that you're going to discover very soon. And then this came to be on June 22nd, 1941, with inevitable results that we are going to see in and understand in the next few episodes. Mm-hmm. So in order to understand this, you need to have a 2 minutes crash course on the German military and how the German military came to became the Wehrmacht. So Germany had this structure called the German General Staff, which was created after the Napoleonic War, because one of the lessons the Prussian military understood of the Napoleonic War is that war had to be treated as a sort of scientific subject. So and it need to be studied, and there needed to be a class of, let's say, trained and, let's say, educated, this is the word I wanted to find, military, not just people fighting the battles, but people understanding history, understanding all the subject related to the military, and try to create what was a sort of codified form of warfare. And
this is what Clausewitz comes out of?
Exactly. Yeah. We're exactly going there. The first result of this was von Clausewitz on war, which is still actually is a surprisingly readable book if one takes in account the fact that it was written in over several years, you know, in the first part of the first half of the 19th century. But it's still very interesting. But now comes the first paradox. The first paradox is that Clausewitz was pushing for a heuristic, let's call it heuristic understanding of war, where war was, as the famous saying goes, the continuation of the politics with different means. So in his view, in the view of the people who created the German General Staff, war was something subject to the decision of politics. Politics may be the king, maybe the chancellor, like Bismarck, maybe the parliament, maybe whatever you want. But the political elite should be informed on military things and give to the military the strategic direction. The military should be subject to that. First thing. Second thing is that there are no simple, clear-cut, eternal rules in warfare. This is something Clausewitz really did believe. Clausewitz has a sort of alter ego in the French military, was General de Jomini, which thought exactly the reverse. He thought that, no, there are eternal rules, there are simple rules, we need to strive to try to find those rules and adhere to it.
Like now, scientific laws.
Like, exactly, yeah. Exactly. Now, the paradox is that the German General Staff first begets Clausewitz, but then if you are serious about studying the history of the German military from the first half of the 19th century to 1945, you see that they will inevitably fall on the other camp. The first thing is that they become detached from politics. They start to be extremely ignorant of any kind of a larger scale picture of the situation, like the economical situation, the strategic situation, the political situation, and they become more and more obsessed with what I call the, and this may maybe funny from someone whose namesake is Annibale, is the Annibale, the Annibale syndrome. The Annibale syndrome is a disease that has affected and still affects a lot of militaries across the world, is the fact that they, at some point, they start to think, I need to do, to be able to create my own version of the Battle of Cannes. You know, Battle of Cannes, the perfect battle, and the perfect encirclement and destruction of a Roman army by Hannibal during the Second Punic War. And everybody has been obsessed. The Confederacy was obsessed with that. The German were obsessed with that. Napoleon was obsessed with that. A lot of Patton was obsessed with that. A lot of people.
Patton was there, if you. But yeah, okay.
Yeah, and there is this continuous idea that you win through the decisive battle of maneuver, the brilliant maneuver. This, of course, forgets conveniently that first thing first, Hannibal lost the war, never won a war he was involved in. And second thing, the main reason, because Cannes was such a brilliant battle, is that the Roman commander, Terenzio Varrone, the consul Terenzio Varrone, did everything that Hannibal needed to win the battle. Basically, he put himself into a desperate situation, more than any brilliant. But still, this idea of the Kesselschlacht, the cauldron battle, the decisive battle that demonstrates how good you are and will win the war, is something that goes through like a fil rouge in all the history of the German command. Again,
Can I stop you? How is this related to something that's very big in the U.S., especially since the Vietnam War, and it just keeps returning? Which is that if it weren't for the politicians, well, this becomes big in Germany too after World War One. If it weren't for the politicians, the cowardly, corrupt, not manly enough politicians, and just the kind of the muddleness of politics as opposed to the hard logic of war, you know, we would win. And so if you unleash the military, as you said, you know, untether it from politics as if it could be untethered and for good or for success, like, is this a similar tendency you're talking about here?
Absolutely, yes, because this is central in our story, the stab in the back myth at the end of World War One, because it's the evolution of the German high command goes like this. The last real Kesselschlacht, sorry, tonight my German is worse than usual, they win is Sadowa or Königsgrätz, the culminating battle of the Austro-Prussian War in 1866. It is probably the last battle in the history of Europe where a single battle decided the war. Right. After that, even in 1870, Sedan, the battle where Napoleon III is completely defeated, doesn't decide the war. Because the French Republic will continue the war for a long time, and the war is going to be decided partially by the battlefield, but so because of the politics, because at some point Bismarck decide the whole thing is going to on, and so on and so forth. But still, the German High Command is convinced to be, you know, to have this key of the absolute genius of the battle, and so as long as they afforded to fight, they will win. And this thing culminates in the Schlieffen plan at the beginning of World War One. Schlieffen is the head of the German General Staff. He creates this plan that will, in his view, will surely win World War One on the Western Front. The plan is implemented and then it fails, and the historiography in Germany and the political discourse in Germany goes on like, say, well, we did fail because we weren't hard enough and committed enough to commit the last reserve. So this is 1914, and the war.
The plan was perfect. It was the leaders let us down. Yeah,
exactly.
It's like the Democratic Party. The leaders of the party are perfect. It's the voters that keep letting them down. So yeah,
exactly. Precisely.
Need to be replaced. Yeah,
and this transform what was supposed to be a short war will be on by Christmas. They were convinced. The Germans were convinced by that. Into a 5 years slog with millions of people dead, the trench warfare, so on and so forth. And still, after the stalemate, the main stalemate that goes from 1914 to 1916, in the last 2 years of the war, because there is an evolution of the military thinking, because there are new technologies, because, you know, everything evolves. The war starts to move again. And at this point, Germany is convinced they're going to win, and then the home front collapses in 1918, and the war is over. And they will end the war with this set of myths that are going to obsess them right through World War II. First myth, we could have won in Paris if we have committed the last reserve. Second myth, we won a clear-cut victory in 1914 on the Eastern Front at the Tannenberg Battle, and we did destroy the Russians, and the Russian army is completely incompetent, will always be incompetent. We demonstrated with that. Third myth, we lost. We were going to win the war, but we were betrayed by socialists, the Jews, the unmanly politician at home, and the home front that did collapse. And the collapse of the home front, of course, is not a collapse of because the people were starving. At some point, Germans were starving.
Yes.
At the end of World War One, is because the morale, you know, the will to fight. And so this set of myth, this mythology is accompanied by another obsession that is central in the history of Barbarossa. And this obsession derives from Germany geography. Germany is in the middle of Europe, so it seems to be destined always to fight on two fronts. If it doesn't have a clear-cut alliance in the West, it will fight in the East. If it has not his back covered in the East, is going to fight in the West. So this idea that the war on two fronts was the main problem Germany had to solve in order to win continental hegemony is something that is stuck in the head of the German High Command and the head of Adolf Hitler too, and the Nazi politician for a long time. This idea, how can we solve this conundrum? And this goes against the common perception that Germany was terrified at the idea of fighting a two fronts war. This is not strictly true, because they thought that war on two fronts at some point was inevitable, and they came with this magic formula that was championed by Hitler, is, oh, we need to keep our war short and victorious. If we fight first in one front and we win, finally, we have a final victory on one side, we can concentrate on the other side and win a final victory there. But this means having a super duper ultra efficient and fast lightning army, and of course, because Nazis is Nazis, we need to have this will to fight. Remember, Adolf Hitler, the key element, the key belief of National Socialism, of Hitler, to think is that the will overcomes any kind of difficulty. You know, the triumph of the will. The will.
It's a more popular idea, especially in military circles in a lot of countries, than one would think. Maybe there's a specific version of it to Hitler and the Nazis, but the whole idea of Elan is what wins battles.
It's not just Elan. It's magical thinking. It's the will.
Yes.
If you, it's this idea that if you want something strongly, this will is going to happen. And this is the first thing. The second thing that is typical of absolutely central into the ideology of Nazism is that the will is the will of a certain kind of people with pure blood, with a certain type of ethnicity. Only those, they have this magical power to conjure up victory no matter what. Okay. Mm-hmm. And part of Hitler's obsession with the Jews and part of the reason of his anti-Semitism is the fact that he thinks that, oh, the Jews are going to corrupting this because they are corrupting the purity of blood, and the purity of blood is what makes a nation great and able to conquer. He's a strong believer in social Darwinism, which is, again, one of the reasons why Nazism is not communism. Is in Nazism, the triumph of the strong against the weak is central.
Yeah.
And Hitler repeats it again and again and again. We need to harden ourselves, to be cruel, to be ruthless, to triumph over our enemies, because the strong always triumph over the weak. And Barbarossa is, and in the decision to launch Barbarossa, this is one of the central motive. Now, why, when is the decision comes and why? You have to picture the situation. When World War II starts, Hitler is able, because of a large set of circumstances that will be interesting to discuss, but we don't have the time, to manage to sign a non-aggression pact with Soviet Union, where that allows him to have the Eastern Front covered for a time in order to concentrate on the Western Front. This is part a result of a certain set of circumstances, particularly also the stupidity of the Western politician at the time, and also Stalin's obsession with the idea of a buffer, because Stalin, of course, knew that sooner or later he would have been at war with Germany, with the West, and he needed to have trade time for more space and for the possibility to reinforce the Red Army. But for Hitler, this was important because in his view, the main enemy in 1931, 1940, the main enemy, the dangerous enemy, was in the West and not in the East. He had a very dim view of the Soviet Union and the Red Army. His conviction was that it was absolutely inferior. They were, you know, the worst people in the earth, but not just because he did misread some of the elements linked with the purges that we have discussed in a recent episode, or anything else. It was ideological. It was this thing, because this is a country that has been, whose Germanic element, remember, part of the Russian nobility was in charge of the country in the 19th century, was part of German blood.
Right. Okay? Alexandra was a princess from a German family.
Exactly.
And the Romanovs had a lot of German blood in them.
Exactly. And they say the revolution just wiped out the German blood that was able to rule the unruly and barbarous Slavs. And so at the moment, this is the worst, because there is this ideology based on equality, based on planned economy. That was another thing that Hitler detested, because he thought that the state was in charge of the ethics of a country, not the economics. The economics were you should give the general direction, but then the economics was best left to the specialists, to the entrepreneurs. This idea of the genius manager, you know.
The industrialists, they're also uber mentioned, right?
So exactly.
The private industrialists, exactly. And the more successful, the more uber they were.
Hitler despised the fight, you know, the bankers, because
yes.
He think, oh, there are people who makes money out of money.
Yes.
But absolutely, he is worshipping this idea of the genius German manager, the genius German entrepreneur that can, you know, create the fabulous things, and out of these of German technology and so on and so forth. But going back to
whereas communism is, especially in the Nazi mind, but in a lot of liberal minds too of that time, is an ideology that favors what they would consider the weak,
exactly,
the lower orders, the weak, to defeat the natural rulers, which would be the rich and the nobility and so on.
Yes, but in particularly what disgusted Hitler about Bolshevism was this idea that blood, nationality didn't mean anything,
right.
Which was absolutely for him. It was absolutely, you know, the contrary of whatever he believed.
Yes.
But then going back, so he thinks in 1939, 1940, I need to take care of the West before I will turn East. But there is now the devil, as usual, is in the details. The reality is, this has been demonstrated many, many times. The Germany economy is not doing well at the beginning of World War II. It's not doing well because it is an economy that's been forced into militarization that is not the kind of ruthless militarization of the society achieved by the Soviets, where everything at a certain point is everything, is going to war, that we need to become a modern nation in order to fight the next war. It's something where, well, we need to increase the army, we need to increase our military might, but at the same time, we need to keep the home front happy. So we will never enter, they don't enter any kind of war economy until it's too late. They are subject, they don't mechanize the agriculture, which is also important. They still keep going with this very backward harms based agriculture, while in Soviet Union they're using tractors at a scale that is unseen anywhere else in Europe. So they are really dependent, particularly on food. They are really dependent on the the years and the imports and anything else. So you have this tale of two economies, one that is the one that is projected toward the rest of the world. So we are a very modern country. We are, you know, having a middle class, as having a vacuum cleaner before anybody else, and so on and so forth. And on the other end, their particularly their food chain is in tatters. Also, they are favoring increase of the military spending that is not planned. There is not any kind of general manager of the German military. It's all based on how Hitler wakes up in the morning and the last owner of a giant weapon factory that comes to him and say, oh, I have this fantastic idea for this tank. I have this fantastic idea for this gun. And also what the army thinks is going to be better for the future. There is this 4 years plan, which is the closest thing that the Nazi Germany did to have some kind of planning of the economy, which is simply a very, very crude set of indication where you will need to have such and such
goals,
vision and goals and anything else. But There is no direction.
An indication here is that, you know, I remember this, that Fred Koch, so he's one of the founders of the John Birch Society here and the father of Charles Koch, you know, the big libertarian right-wing funder and the oil magnate. But Fred actually made his first big nut building refineries with a new kind of cracking refinery technology for Stalin in the big modernization in the late 20s or in the early 30s. But he hated it there, you know, and became more fiercely reactionary. And then he went to Germany, helped the Germans build one of the airplane fuel refineries. And yes, he wrote glowing letters from there saying, these guys know how to do it right. The workers are happy. They don't strike. Everything is modern. A manager is a manager and a worker is a worker in Nazi Germany. And this is the future. And also like the International Chamber of Commerce, which I think was headquartered in the U.S. at, you know, the larger version of the American Chamber of Commerce. I think it was like in 1937 or 38, they held a big meeting in Nazi Germany praising it. So, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of revisionism going on, but they praised Nazi Germany, I think, for this reason, because it was not super centrally managed, the economy, that it let the rich get rich and kept workers in their place.
Yes, that's what it is. But it's interesting to note that these deficiencies, vulnerabilities of the German economy, at some point are exploited by the Soviet German non-aggression pact, because part of the Soviet the articles of the Soviet German pact is that both countries are going to increase their mutual spending one toward the other, and one of trade. The provision is that the trade, yeah, mm-hmm. the trade that is not really a trade in the modern sense, let's say exchange
like
of mm-hmm. mostly raw material from Soviet Union and technology from Germany,
right?
But is really Germany is spending money. Is money from Germany and raw material coming from Soviet Union. And more and more, Germany in the war effort 1939-1940 becomes dependent from these imports, which is not exactly, it goes contrary right. to what Hitler wanted to achieve, because he wanted to be independent and is in part independent from the British blockade. But at some point, he discovered, well, I'm dependent as long as those guys are sending me stuff. And while in a different situation, a different leader while being worried about raw material for the war effort, what the central obsession, Hitler's central obsession is food. We're sending us grain, and we don't have enough grain, and Ukraine is the granary of Europe. And this theme is going to increase more and more and more and more, not just in Hitler views, but also particularly in the army. I'm going to show you why. What happens is that June 1940, the Phoney War ends. Germany strikes West, wins this incredibly short and rapid victory against France. No one is more surprised by the speed of this victory than Germany, because everybody, I mean, we don't have the time right now. But
yeah,
but
their last planning, experience was not so
was
good
not
with
good.
France.
Yeah. It's not good. And the whole thing, the whole planning of Fall Gelb, the operation against France is a mess. They start with a repetition of what is 1914 plan, with a very mediocre plan. Hitler doesn't like it, and then von Manstein arrives and proposed the so-called the Siegel stroke, not just attacking through Belgium, but cutting off Belgium from and those all the forward detachment of the German of the French and British defensive system, cutting off from the Ardennes through Dunkirk through the sea in order to separate the two parts of the army and then aim at destroying the northern concentration of the Allied defensive system and then go toward Paris. Thus avoiding completely to be stuck into, particularly on the Maginot Line, on the Western Front, on France Eastern Frontiers, but also avoiding what had been the main problem in 1914, the slow movement toward Paris and the need to envelop Paris in a very large encirclement that in the end did fail. But it's still a mess, because if it wasn't, by the way, Hitler doesn't like Manstein, he detests him, but he still say, well, this plan may work, and the plan is adopted despite the fact that the German High Command seems to think it will never work, and then it works. And everybody is, oh my God, the Führer was right. This is the moment where everybody, from June 1940 to July 1941, this is the Eig tide moment of Hitler popularity. Everybody thinks, oh, he was a genius. He did the right thing because he decided to use this daring plan. Everybody was convinced that it would have failed and he won, so maybe he's right and we are going to be the master of Europe. And at this point, Hitler has a credibility that is, particularly political, he could spend anywhere. And, and Hitler is convinced at this point that Britain will sue for peace because they say nobody could. I mean, they are alone, they are cut off from the continent, they have a very small army, and yes, they are a large navy, but you know, and there is no need for us to fight because deep down, Hitler is convinced that Britain is a good country that has been somehow ruined by the Jews, of course, but it's still not as bad as the United States, okay? Mm-hmm. Where in Hitler, you know, view Jews are running completely a show. So he still decide things on the basis of this fantasy version of, but again, it's not just him. Everybody else inside the army. I mean, 90% of the army, but also a lot of the people inside the industry, they are thinking, yeah, I mean, we don't need really to fight with Great Britain. And this is the moment where they say, where is right now? What do we need? And they say, we need to make sure we will find some kind of agreement with Britain. But Britain is resisting. And everybody after the war will say, this was just Hitler's idea, but it's not. This is something that is actually discussed inside the German High Command. If Britain is resisting because there is still a Soviet Union. And they still think that, yes, we have this makeshift pact with them that everybody knows is not going to last long. But as long as there is the Soviet Union, Britain will resist. And this is not a very intelligent point, because actually, at the moment, Churchill, yes, I think maybe it would be nice if Stalin and Hitler would argue. But at that moment, of course, Churchill is looking at the United States. And in the United States, Roosevelt is absolutely doing his best to pull strings and maneuver a very recalcitrant Congress into authorizing him to spend more and more money helping the Great Britain, despite the fact that the U.S. and Germany are still not at war.
How much does this play a part in it? First of all, the general idea that not just Hitler, but kind of, you know, coalesced in Hitler, but also a lot of German military and business people, that nevertheless, like, they didn't really want to fight a war with Britain. They actually kind of admired the British Empire. For them, it was like a model for Aryan rule, Aryan supremacist rule. But they did want to make, as you said, Ukraine and parts of Russia and the parts of the Soviet Union their colony. And that goes way beyond Hitler. Are you going to talk about that a little
bit? Yes. It's something that comes from the end of the, I mean, the Lebensraum and the Drang nach Osten is not something that's invented by Hitler. It's something that comes from the end of the 19th century. There's a very long tradition of people saying this is where, because we are the bulwark against the Eastern hordes, the Mongol hordes, and our destiny is to expand there, because it was a genius nation constrained into a tiny space. But there is actually is more nuanced than this, because there is one part of the German military that really, in fact, wanted to continue the war against Britain and try to keep the Soviet-German pact as long as possible. And this was the Navy. Mm. The Navy was traditionally very anti-British, the German Navy. Yeah. German, for a lot of reasons, particularly because there was a lot of people that have been for a long time in German, in British captivity during World War One, and they hated that. Mm. They absolutely detested that. Raeder, the head of the German Navy, was very vocal about the fact, no, we should, and he proposed a completely different strategy, which was the Mediterranean strategy. We need to attack, we need to keep the Eastern Front calm, and we need to attack Britain, particularly in the Mediterranean, with the help of the Italian. We need to attack Britain in the Persian Gulf. Maybe we could convince the Soviet to invade Iran. And if they invade Iran, we could, for instance, try to expand some kind of limited attrition, naval attrition warfare into the Persian Gulf, into the Indian Ocean. And maybe we should, this could also help us to take care of our relationship with Japan a bit better, despite the fact that Japan at this moment is really entangled into the Chinese quagmire.
Incredible. The Germans just blow. You know, your magical thinking is silly. My magical thinking, on the other hand, I mean, it's really, for such a smart people, I mean, not just, okay, as a people, but also they fought very well and so on. We saw this when we went over, we did an episode on Germany's many, like, incredibly stupid thinking mistakes in World War One that made their defeat inevitable. And it's just mind-boggling, the blinders. But we see today, you still see it all the time, but it is, looking back in hindsight, it really is mind-boggling.
Hitler is not convinced, but he's not convinced because they say the whole thing is, the right answer to this plan would be, okay, that's good. Which navy are going to use?
Yes.
Because we don't have one.
Okay? Yes, the great German navy.
Every time somebody was proposing something like that with the larger use of the navy, I think Hitler was reminded of what happened to the Blücher outside Oslo. That was, sunk by a World War One era fortress with torpedoes. Mm. And so it was, No, we want to do that. But Hitler's decision not to do that is also because he thinks, is in our best interest to destroy or to limit the British power? Because in Hitler's mind, he still thinks, I may convince the Brits to start, not a war, maybe start to detach from the United States, which is... It's stupid. This is stupid. Yeah. This is really stupid. But he writes about that. Well, not writes, because he never writes anything. But he discussed this in his table talks about, well, maybe I could convince Churchill to that Roosevelt cannot be trusted because the Jews and blah, 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 blah.
I'm sorry, there is a quote here. Where is this? This may even be from, I think this is from Mein Kampf. In Europe, there is only a single ally, Britain. Only with Britain covering our backs could we set out on the new Teutonic migration. No sacrifice is too large in winning Britain's goodwill.
Yeah, I mean, Churchill goodwill is as stupid as it seems. Yeah. Believe me, Churchill goodwill. Oh my. Okay. And then what happens in June 1940 and July 1940 is that the army, independently from Hitler, start to, design feasibility studies with a war in the East. And again, after the war, they are going to say, no, but it was because Hitler started to, at some point, to make gestures toward the East. So we decided to be proactive. But actually, the first movement is something that comes, the structure of the German army in 1940, between 1939 and 1945, is that they have two main directorate. One is the OKW, which is a sort of joint forces office.
Like a joint chiefs of staff sort of thing?
Yeah, joint chiefs of staff, exactly. Okay. That is created, it's completely artificial, it's created by Hitler in order to avoid a war, a real war department. He doesn't want to have one. He wants to control the whole thing. So he creates these bogus joint forces council.
Where the commanders of the different branches
meet together. But he puts at the command of at the head of these people, two yes men will always agree with him. That is Jodl and Keitel. And then there is the real, and of course, this is also where the Luftwaffe and the Navy are heard. Mm-hmm. And then on a completely separate part, we are the OKH, Oberkommando des Heeres, which is the real general staff. And this is an organization that is controlled purely by the army. It's political because they're really Nazi, every single one of them, but is not controlled directly by a political body. And one of the things that always makes people wonder about the OKH, also the OKW, is the fact that they are considered the non plus ultra in terms of military thinking in 1940, but they are tiny. They are really tiny. And when you discover that there were never in the entire Germany ever more than 600 people who could be able to work in the general staff. Not that they were working. People trained to do that. No more than 600 people. And you think how the Pentagon is, or even how the Soviet military bureaucracy was. I mean, you cannot have 17 people, 20 people, no matter how well trained they are running a modern military machine. So the fact that they are keeping, because they want to keep the whole thing small and they want to keep the whole thing elite, because in order to have a real functioning military bureaucracy, they will need to expand it to people they don't like, the civilians. Mm-hmm. And this is something, keeping the whole thing elite is also another of the obsession that the German general staff has. We need to keep it in the family. We need
by elite, you mean ideologically deeply committed Nazis or people that they think are just superior in military doctrine and Nazis?
People who went through the war school, that kind of war school, okay, where there was a huge selection. And they all became Nazi. Because they were all Nazi. They were all really committed Nazi. But the thing is, you were not... this is major difference with the Soviet Union. You were not getting the job, at least in 1940, because you had the party membership card. Okay, while unfortunately in Soviet Union a lot of people got the job because they thought he's a good communist. Mm-hmm. You were not getting the job because you were a good Nazi. You were getting the job because they thought you had done the right schools. Mm-hmm. That means the right
pedigree.
War schools. The pedigree. That's mm-hmm. it. That is not necessary a family pedigree because there was also yes. people who went into the army, and it was from this point of view you had this kind of meritocracy. But it was a very twisted sense of meritocracy, because the whole thing is that you had to be part of a group thinking mm-hmm. that had not really evolved since the mid-20s and had learned all the wrong the wrong lessons.
So basically credentialed at the right places with the right thinking, getting the right upbringing, the right thinking. I mean, I hate to make this because I know this is a stretch again, but this really is kind of like the Democratic, the DNC thinking as well. Like you come from three Ivy League universities or you know, with this private school. I know it's different, but it's like that fixation on your pedigree, your credentials is
the idea is the fact that I mean, you can have the exception, but they were not exception. Paulus, who became famous in Stalingrad, who was one of the main planners of Barbarossa, came from a very modest family. He was not nobility, he was not von Paulus. Everybody very often calls him von Paulus. It was not a von. But he came from that pedigree because he had made his way through. First, I fought in World War One, but then I made his way through this whole thing of the war school and becoming a staff officer in the right staff, and then evolving into that and becoming, you know, being considered a leading theoretician because basically he had been through the right jobs, because he had been through the right education, okay? Notwithstanding his relatively modest origins, okay? Rommel was different. Rommel was never staff. I mean, they thought that the fighting general and the staff general were two different things. You could become a fighting general, a Model or Rommel, with, you know, a very modest pedigree, and nobody will care. Only your ability to fight, and in this case, sometimes your closeness to the ideological thinking of Nazis, this will help you. But in the general staff, you had to be part of this. As you say, having done the right schools is a very fitting comparison. So they start to, the German army, the OKW and the OKH, they start those feasibility studies. The first one is called the Marx, because a German, the person who is in charge of the study is General Marx. Everybody, particularly in Russia, in current Russia, historical channel and blogs, they are at pain to tell you, is Marx with GK, not with X. Nothing to do with the famous economic philosopher. Okay, and they try to insist on that. And this feasibility study is very simple. Say, well, we can, in order to attack, we need to have a northern wing north of the Pripyat marshes and a southern wing south of the Pripyat marshes. And these wings need to, at some point, to expand toward north toward Leningrad and south toward Odessa and Sevastopol, and then reconcentrate again, attack Moscow, and arrive to a line, a final line that goes from the famous AA line, Arkhangelsk to Astrakhan, which is going to be the end line. And everybody is going, in 17 weeks, we're going to win the war. Is a ideously simplistic proposal. There is no...
The beauty is in its simplicity, dude.
Okay. It's part from the idea that the Germany needs 140 divisions with 20 Panzer divisions. They had 10 in France, and they are aiming to have 20, 24 by the start of Barbarossa. And that... probably Soviet Union are 96. Later they say, well, maybe it's 130. But there is absolutely zero indication about reserve, about logistic, about economics, nothing. Is we come, we see, we conquer. Okay? Veni, vidi, vici. And is this makes it essentially useless from a realistic point of view. But this is not considered like that, because the idea is, at this point, the German army, more than Hitler, is convinced that, well, we won in few weeks against France, who was considered the best army in Europe.
This is a repeated sort of, you know, aphorism or something, is that victory is a terrible teacher. And you see that over and over.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, these people are starting to believe their own propaganda. Yes. They really believe they have invented Blitzkrieg, even if it's not Blitzkrieg, it was combined arm, a very messy sort of combined arm operation that they need to refine and refine again, and will never become anything as structured, as well-designed as the battle operation on the Soviet side. They really believe that. They really believe, well, we need to have tanks, we need to have airplanes, Stukas, and we need to have infantry going back. The most egregious part of the Marx plan is that the fact is that, look, guys, I can understand. I'm saying, look, guys, from an Hannibal point of view, if I had German general staff in front of me, look, guys, I understand you don't understand much about the Soviet Union. That's okay. Very secretive country, whatever you want. But I think you know. They have 190 to 200 million people. How can you think they cannot conjure up reserves? Particularly because in 1939 they have reintroduced, well, actually it was from 1935, but the latest version is 1939. They have reintroduced universal military conscription. Mm-hmm. You should think about that. Okay. Nothing. Crickets.
So a couple things I would say here. One is, and I know we don't have time to get into it, but we should at least mention it, the seemingly poor performance of the Soviets in the Soviet-Finnish War when they invaded Finland, and at first did very poorly. It genuinely did very poorly, which is a very Russian thing to start off a war doing very poorly, but whatever. And that gave them confidence. And the other thing is, let's be honest. I mean, the way the Nazis were able to take, you know, continental Europe, west of Poland, west of Ukraine, I guess you'd say, so quickly, like even Napoleon couldn't do it that quickly with that few casualties. They didn't really start racking up serious casualties until Yugoslavia and Crete, as far as I know. It just seemed like
Crete.
Especially Crete. And that's right before Barbarossa, so all the plans were already in place. So you can see why they were high on their own supply about how awesome and well ahead they were. And, you know, and they also didn't know what Radio Warnerd listeners know, which is the truth about Nomenhan and the battles against the Japanese and how well the Russians did in that.
But they knew about it. Actually, they have heard about it, and particularly because the Japanese were making funny noises saying, a war against the Soviet Union. The last time
we're going to opt out of that. Yeah.
I'll tell you what. In 1940, even the Swiss counterintelligence thought the whole thing was desperate. Mm. Okay. And they did, because they just ignored the fact that you're going to see very soon the evolution of this thing. Because now this is Marx's feasibility studies is the one from OKH, and then the OKV is his own. It's called the Lossberg study. And the Losberg study become the more famous of the two because it will be used in Nuremberg during the Nuremberg trials to demonstrate that there was a war of aggression going on against the Soviet Union. And this is somehow more sensible because it is not a two-pronged attack. It is three main direction of attack. So Army Group North, Army Group Center, Army Group South. And it takes in account a lot of, this is the first study that say, well, probably they are going to rise up more division. They may have a reserve, but they come up with a completely idiotic number because they say they have 130 division in place and they might have 30 more. And the reality,
so the Nazi command or Marx or whoever's making this plan says they have the Soviets have 130 divisions and maybe 30 in reserve.
30, 40 in reserve. Uh-huh. And that's it. Okay. Yeah. And the reality is that at the moment when the war starts, the Soviet Union has 300 and they can have another 100.
Yeah,
is the fact that there is double that number. Okay, right. And when they discover that, in August they start to say, "Well, hold on, it's not possible." Okay, is 190 million, 200 million large population? Oh, interesting. We didn't thought about it. So this is more sensible, is more, but it's still something, you know, where in general, they say, we can do it. Yes, we can do it, but how we can do it? Yes, there is going to be difficulties. Maybe they're going to offer resistance. By the way, both plans, the first Marx plan says, the first thing we need to do is to avoid the retreat into the Soviet space, you know, shadows of 1812. We don't want to go into that, so we need to grab them and destroy them in the frontier. And then there is going to be what is called a railroad advance, because they think we just have to move the troops on the railroads and go toward Moscow. You know, really, seriously. Yeah. Of course, this is the moment where they start to realize which railroads, because the gauge of Soviet railroads is larger.
Yeah, is
larger. And this is going to make for an extremely funny diversion later on. Mm. And Losberg, the subsequent Losberg plan, is a bit more prudent on that. And they say, well, we have probably three different options. One option is that we fight the battles on the frontier, and that's it. The second and most likely is the fact that they are not going to allow themselves to be destroyed on the frontier. They're going to try to make a stand on the Dnieper. And the third one is that they're going to retreat into the Russian space. But everybody's convinced that they won't do it because, and rightly so, they think they cannot leave Ukraine and they cannot leave all the valuable stuff around Kharkiv and Kursk and the whole industrial base.
The Donbass and
Donbass or whatever, they cannot leave it.
Basically the breadbasket and the coal and kind of industrial heartland.
Exactly. They can't do it. So they are going to fight, and they are right about that. Mm-hmm. But still, no maps. They say it's all based on suppositions.
Vibes.
It's all based on vibes. It's all based on 1970s map. At some point, they are going to discover that the only maps they have beyond the immediate 300, 400 kilometers are map coming from the 1870s.
Wow.
In the Caucasus, where they're going eventually to arrive in the Caucasus in 1942, they're going to have maps dating from the 1870s.
That's wild.
I'm not making this up. And so they don't have maps. And at some point, the military geographical office of the Wehrmacht timidly started to say, well, look, we did studies on that. And the roads in Russia are terrible. And there is not a terrain. It's a terrain where Yes, it's a terrain that is good for certain types of tracked vehicles, but maybe the one that we have are not right. And you are now, I'll make you take a wild guess. How many types of motor vehicles did the Wehrmacht add on the eve of Barbarossa? How many different models?
I wouldn't even be able to guess. But maybe
say one number.
Okay, 50. I don't know.
2,000.
Whoa. Okay. Yeah. Wow. yes. Because that's private enterprise there, you know.
It's not just that. It's that they are plundering trucks and everything all across Europe. They have plundered all the French motor, whatever kind of French motor transport they could have. They plundered.
Every country they take over, they just take over their light tanks, their trucks, their whatever armored vehicles.
There are two Panzer divisions that are entirely equipped with SEC tanks and nothing else. There are two, okay?
With Czech tanks, okay.
And now, I think you may guess that French trucks maybe are not the best option for overland transportation in Russia. You have been there, so you know a bit the terrain. Okay.
Yeah, you need a big commas. That's what you need. Yeah.
Okay. And so at this point, whatever is the thing, they started to have contrary voices. And these voices are either ignored or completely turned upside down. The most famous is General Thomas, who is the quartermaster of the army, who comes with these things and says, look, we may advance 300 with the kind of stuff we have right now. If we need to feed the 300,000 horses, because it is, remember, the Wehrmacht is a horse, is a foot and hoof based army. They're just 20, they're going to have 20.
There are films that make it seem like they're totally modern and totally mechanized, in reality, it's still...
The 20 Panzer Division, 12 Motorized Division, and the other 120, they're walking or going by horse. Mm-hmm. And Wagner says, we are going to have 300,000 horse, and in the end, they're going to have 600,000 horse, not 300,000. And 500,000 motor vehicles, and we will need to feed 2 million, at least 2 million. They will end up with 3.5 million people. And for doing just that, we can advance for 600 kilometers, and then it's over. We don't have enough supply to move on. The 600, and at the moment, with the kind of timetable they have in mind, 600 kilometers, because they think they can advance non-stop for 20 days. Actually, what happens is that the stop happens after just the first 15. But they just think, after that, it's over. We will need to leave off the land. To either we start to plunder mercilessly whatever we find in Soviet Union, or it's over. And the obvious answer from the military and from Hitler is, we will just do that.
Yes.
Oh, that's a perfect idea. We can win if we are, of course, we are going to crush those Untermenschen sooner than that. But if for any reason they resist, we're going just to plunder off the land. And they start to make extremely detailed. They don't have a real logistical plan, but they are very detailed, the so-called green folders, because the covers are always green. This amazingly detailed plan made by the agriculture department of the German government, over plundering non-stop for food and leaving. They divide the Russia into surplus and deficit region. And so they're going, the surplus region, we are going to steal whatever they have and leave the minimum to keep the people living to run at least the agriculture. On the deficit places like Belorussia or Northern Russia, we don't need the people. they're going just to starve. That's it.
I mean, this is what informs the absolute brutality that they wage. But part of the, on the peoples of the former Soviet Union, on the Ukrainians, on the Belarusians, on the Jews, I mean, the Jews, other things inform that as well. Right? But I think part of their plan that everything's going to go great, I keep reading, is also the idea that that the communist regime, the Stalin's regime, whatever, was as unpopular in Russia, in you know, even including like Eastern Ukraine or Belarus, was as unpopular there as it is in Germany, as it was in Germany, that everybody hated them. All it needed was a push and the whole thing was going to collapse.
Again, exactly.
We have echoes of like, you know, the Iraq invasion thinking, which also had very, just the rosiest assumptions in the Iraq war.
Exactly. Like, yeah. And again, one could excuse themselves because they say, yeah, it's ideology, but they didn't have the information. But this is not true. Have you ever heard, I don't know if you have read Adam Tooze's The Wages of Destruction. He mentioned it in the book. Have you ever heard of the Walter Memorandum?
No.
Walter was a specialist into the German embassy in Moscow, who wrote to Franz Halder, the head of the staff of the OKH, in November 1940, this memorandum that is always quoted, even Tooze quotes it for me for the wrong reason, because at some point there is at the end of this memorandum, there is a line saying, we won't achieve anything by getting Ukraine. It was a disappointment, even World War One. The population is too large, and if we kill the population, nobody is going to be there to farm and to collect the
harvest all the fruit.
The harvest grain. To harvest and so on. And so forth. But this is not what I've searched through because it was unavailable until I discovered a German book. Very detailed German book that reports it completely. So I read it through in German, and it is amazing. Because what Walter says is that I think you are having the wrong impression about the Soviet regime. It's not unpopular. Maybe it's not completely popular, but it's not unpopular. It works. The internal opposition is minimal. It is all completely, completely controlled and mercilessly destroyed by the NKVD. Actually, the industry is working very well. Actually, the whole movement of the industry toward the Urals has been going on for a while. So it doesn't work like this. And the Alder received this. It's something coming from someone who is there. Walter makes also a lot of, you know, funny conclusion. Like he say, well, one of the reasons they are doing so good is that they got rid of most of the Jews, which is not true. That they are sent the women back to the kitchen, which is not true. Mm. So it's not.
He's given an ideological report.
Because this guy, by the way, is famous because he's the one who, after Barbarossa, he was sent in Libya to be a sort of attaché with the Italians. Mm-hmm. And he was the one at some point wrote that, yes, there is going to be also a solution to the Jewish problem, even in North Africa, which is a quote that has been used again and again and again. So, but by the way, coming back to our subject.
Coming back to the subject, though, it's a contradiction here because the German invasion, the success and speed of it relied on everybody welcoming them because they hate this regime, this rotten communist, Judeo-communist, but also exploiting them and killing them. So it's like,
exactly. But yeah. The point is, the first part, there is, for instance, there is Rosenberg who really think, we should have a rump Ukrainian state. Mm-hmm. But he's completely sidelined on that. But he's not sidelined much by Hitler. Is sidelined by the Wehrmacht. Is the Wehrmacht say, listen, we cannot have these people. We just need to steal, exploit.
Yes.
Because we need these people's stuff to win the war. And once the war is won, we're going to plunder everything. There's this booty list made by the German industry. And we're talking about, everybody mentioned IG Farben. But there was also Siemens, there was also BMW, there was also IG, there was also Allianz, there was also Porsche, and so on and so forth. I mean, a lot of companies that are still with us today. Okay. Right. And they had booty lists. They say, oh, we need that. We know because we had collaborated with Russia in the past. So we know that there is such and such and such and such industry and such center of technology and such source of raw material. Please bring them back to us.
Right.
Okay. Booty list. They're called a booty list. And so basically, this is the wave, the idea when at some point, and we are in December 1940, there is a decision that needs to be done in order to, is the decision that precedes the famous Directive 21, the directive with whom Hitler is going to institute Barbarossa. And the only step is to have a real plan. And the plan, the two feasibility studies are given, and a lot of material is given to Paulus, the one that will become famous in Stalingrad. And Paulus start to do the sensible thing, is start to war game the war assumption. And and he discover that the whole thing doesn't work.
Right.
And this is, again, we need to be cautious on this, because Paulus was captured by the Soviet, ended up defecting to the Soviet, and gave extensive information to the Soviet after the war. And this is something that comes from this information. He gave them willingly. He was not tortured. He was really very anxious to give this information because he had a real, he defected. He seriously, genuinely defected to the Soviet. And he was
and defectors really give information that is both self-serving and accurate.
Exactly.
And they make sure that they don't get caught lying, but they also are trying to serve themselves, right?
So, exactly. Yeah. So, we need to be prudent, but we know that he did war game this stuff in November to December 1940. And we are reasonably sure that he discovered right from the beginning what was, I mean, the problems with that. The problems were that it was two armies trying to move simultaneously. The massive panzer, rich motorized army, and the plundering infantry behind. And what they discover is what did happen, like, spoiler for the next episode, is what they did discover is that the panzer army will move and then have to stop because the logistic was not keeping up with them, and wait for the plodding infantry to come up to reach them, also to close the encirclement, and then start again, and then stop, start, stop, start, stop, start, stop, which made the whole idea of concluding the war in 9 to 17 weeks, as the Marx and Loserberg plans had implied, impossible, completely impossible. But again, what came out in the plan was the rosy version. It's impossible if we assume they are going to maintain a steady, the Soviets are going to resist in a steady way. If we assume they are not going to resist, and if we assume that we can concentrate enough forces, and they end, they don't have reserves, or they have a few reserves, and there's going to be a moral collapse, everything will go well. So it is not like they don't have the information. They choose to ignore them.
Yeah.
Okay. And
they're not the only ones that have done that, I have to say. See that again.
So in order to close this initial episode, we need to arrive to the moment where the whole thing is transforming into a plan, and the entire, I mean, the forces that will accomplish or fail in Barbarossa are moved toward the front. The initial plan, so Directive 21 is on December, and is the idea that Hitler asked for an official plan to start the war against the Soviet Union with a possible start date in May 1941. The plan is designed, is in the semi-final form for February, but at this point several things are starting to happen. The first thing is that the let's be serious, the May date is was not realistic because of the weather, because at this point any extension of the Rasputiza season will mean that by May, the muddy season, nobody will be able to move through Soviet Union. And also because the whole thing, again, the plan is we need to have 24 tanks unit ready by May. So this means that we need, by starting from August, to have 640 tanks built every month. How many tanks were they building in September, for instance? 121. So, they start to discover that they are very, very slow on trying to ramping up, particularly the Panzer production. And also there is the thing that there is the entire discussion about the modernization of the Luftwaffe, because at some point there was a change of heart during the summer 1940. Hitler changed his mind, say, well, maybe we should stop for a while the production of tanks and try to send people more in the factory in order to produce more airplanes. We need that. Remember that Germany has not a real strategic aviation. It's all close air support. Air superiority, close air support, okay? And they need to have more of them, and particularly because the Battle of Britain goes as it goes, and then they discover they need the same people to because they have a problem with industrial capacity. They don't have enough people. This is the reason. They started to bring in foreign workers and prisoners, but this is not enough. And so they need to ramp up the production of tanks and the production of guns. And then at some point they start to discover the anti-tank guns probably are not good enough for the task. And they still more or less ignore they are going to have to face 34. And the nail in the coffin of the idea of fighting launching Barbarossa in May is, of course, the fact that at some point Germany is forced to go to help Italy in the Balkans and in Greece. Right. And this means that several units are moved, particularly from the southern wings of the attack, in order to go to the Balkans. This makes the whole debate, because we have ignored right now, we're going to discuss it while we discuss Barbarossa, but remember one thing, Barbarossa is a plan without a goal. The goal is generally, we need to destroy the Red Army between the frontiers and the Dnieper. And then, go toward Leningrad, Kiev, or Moscow. But there is not a real goal. There are these, Astrakhan Arkhangelsk line, which is absolutely crazy. If you know a map of
that's Soviet, assuming a complete vacuum, right? Yeah, that only makes sense if it's like a 1918-esque, vacuum. Even then, it wasn't a vacuum.
Exactly. Nothing. Nothing opposing that. People cheering Hitler as he's come, and so it's. They still don't have this goal. They still, and at this, is this the moment where the dichotomy between Hitler, who thinks, well, I will really want to have Ukraine because I need that food, I need that the Donbass, I need that coal, I need those raw resources, and the military, who thinks, no, we need to conquer Moscow because Moscow is the main logistical and political military hub of Soviet Union. And then both sides arguing about the importance of of Leningrad. So they don't even have a real shared goal for the operational part. In terms of strategy, there is nothing. But even the operational part is that, are we going to push a single advance toward Moscow, or we are going to have to inevitably to stop and turn south in order to conquer Kyiv? There is nothing like that. Nothing.
Just have one thing, because I know we have to wrap it up. This has been great, a great intro. And of course, in the next episode, we will get into actual, you know, Barbarossa. And we'll also, of course, talk about the Soviet side of preparations and the politics and stuff and everything. But I just had one more thing I wanted to emphasize again, because you brought this up in previous episodes. And I think it's a really important way of understanding the German mindset, not even just Hitler. But for them, a goal was, I mean, of course, there's the social Darwinism, there's the racial aspect, which is very important. There's the politics of hatred of Bolshevism, communism, Judeo-Bolshevism, but also a deeper idea that's even kind of predates the Bolshevik Revolution of colonizing, of turning that the rich parts of Western Soviet Union into what India and parts of Africa were for, you know, Britain and some other European countries.
But much worse.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
It was the worst version of that. But it was that. It was colonization.
Yeah.
Pure colonial mindset. And they treated like that because everybody, when I bring up sometimes when I brought up in the past in different venues, the idea of the Hunger Plan. The Hunger Plan was a plan concocted by the Agricultural Office of the Reich in order to starve the Soviet population. Say, what anybody would do anything stupid like that? It's like you want to have eggs and you murder the chickens, okay? But the whole point is, he misses the whole point. The whole idea that is that we want the land of these people. We want the raw material of these people. We want to have few of these people as servants, and everybody else may die or move to Siberia. Mm-hmm. That's it. It's as simple as that, which is a colonial mindset. Mm-hmm. But the difference is that in India or in whatever other place in Africa, there was some vague and hypocritical sense of, well, we are in a, you know, civilization mission. We really admire, so we like some of this culture and so on and so forth. In this case, they just despise them. We want your land. We don't want you. We don't want your culture. We're not interested in that. Mm-hmm. We will raise everything you did to the ground and use your land, your nice land for our colonies.
And it's mask off colonialism, right? As they say, mask off today, without the veneer, the pious veneers of, you know, civilizing mission and stuff. It's pure mask off. I mean, this is the thing. People think they're so badass. You see this in the American right and the European right, you know, by being mask off, as if no one's ever thought of that before, as if it hasn't been tested. It fails also. It's stupid.
It fails. It fails. And this is the reason we can close this episode with this remark. It's bound to fail. Unless you do that to a really, really helpless population.
Yes.
It fails. And of course, I mean, Russia was not helpless by any means of the word.
Good. I think that's a good place to end it. Thank you so much, Anibale. Anibale's Barbarossa, part one. Finished there. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Brendan. And talk to you again soon. Looking forward to part two. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.